The following program is a sports handicapping show. That's right, we will be discussing sports betting and all kinds of other gambling stuff, including game predictions. As you know, not every bet will win, but we do our best. Feel free to use this information at your own risk, and remember, wager wisely, folks.
Broadcasting from the Vegas Video Network studios, live from the Las Vegas Strip, Covers.com presents Vegas Sports Day. And now from the sports betting capital of the world, here are your hosts, Teddy and the Professor.
It's Monday in Sin City, and you are watching Vegas Sports Day, the pulse of the sports betting world. I'm your host, Teddy Covers, joined as always by my esteemed colleague, the Professor, Dave Malinsky.
Coming up today, we're going to lament how one coach drew it up wrong in his Elite Eight endgame strategy. Tired of the Yankees and the Red Sox winning the AL East? We're going to tell you that there may be some rays of hope coming up this summer. And when we head to the NBA tonight, we're going to tell you about a situation which you might want to check the thermostat. There may be more heat coming than you expect.
Dave, first take on a Monday. Great weekend of college basketball action, obviously. Exciting finishes, wild rallies in the closing minutes of a number of games. The first overtime game of the NCAA tournament. No buzzer beaters, though. That being said, give me a first take on a Monday. What did you see that you want to complain about?
Got to be basketball karma. And the little gods coming back to bite us just a little bit. Teddy and I exchange emails a lot over the course of the weekend, talking about show ideas, betting ideas, and whatnot. And, of course, one of the emails that he got sent on Friday night after yet another endgame meltdown, you know, by Scott Drew at Baylor, they won the game against Xavier, didn't cover, is the email, he's just stunningly bad in these situations, but there's an Elite Eight appearance, he's a good recruiter, we're going to get to bet against this guy for a long, long time. So what happens? Drew bites us the opposite way yesterday. We had a pretty decent ticket on Baylor and Kentucky under. And if you followed along with that, it's one of those where really from the 12-minute mark of the first half, you don't even envision any chance that you could lose your bet. Well under control, and also Kentucky with the game under control. So one of the reasons why we bet these unders, when there's a prohibitive favorite, if we don't think the game's going to be close, you know there's none of those end-game shenanigans. And there shouldn't have been. Final 2 minutes, Kentucky up by 15, more than willing to just dribble the clock out. And what does Drew do? He fouls down 15 with a minute 54 left. He fouls down 15 with a minute 37 left. He fouls down 13 with a minute 19 left. He fouls down 11 at a minute 6. He fouls down 10 at 41. And he fouls down 12 when the shot clock is turned off. The very final possession where Kentucky was going to willingly dribble it out and not try to score, he fouled down 12. Now, the anger is not that a ticket gets turned inside out, because that happens every day. You just sort of push that off to the side. It's the idea that a coach doesn't respect the sport. When you get beat that badly, Kentucky has earned something. They've earned that ability on those final possessions to give it back to their crowd, let the clock dribble out, and have that little bit of a crescendo. That's what you play for. They earned it. Yeah, maybe you could say, well, I wanted to foul with a minute 50 left to show my kids we hadn't quit. But when the shot clock is turned off, you're down by 12. You've insulted the sport. You've taken a moment away from Kentucky that those kids earned, and they earned it by whipping your tail. So you took that away from them. Maybe you didn't want to see that celebration. Maybe you were a little bit bitter about it. No. You got to respect the sport, coach. That was a very bad move to have made. Hopefully it's something you will learn from. But, again, a coach that we think we can make money playing against in key situations. Well, he showed us in another key situation yesterday, kind of a lack of maturity. The only problem is this one actually dinged us a little bit in the pocket. We're going to talk baseball today, but you're going to talk basketball first, aren't you?
Of course, but you know, you have to talk Manny being Manny, you know, Baylor being Baylor.
Baylor being
what
Baylor.
What they've done all year long.
Did we coin that one on this show first?
Perhaps.
Baylor being Baylor?
Yeah.
You should get residuals.
All right, well, let's see if you can trademark that. You know, nice, easy process for
when
you.
When the show's over. Yeah, we'll get to that.
First take for me on a Monday is coming back with a team that beat you. And we'll get to this in Money Time as well later on in the show. But we had a situation personally where I had a large wager on Kansas on Friday night against NC State. And what did the Jayhawks do? Well, they're up 8 with 2 minutes to go, 3 minutes to go. NC State's ice cold from the floor. And Kansas in position to win the game, cover the spread, cash my ticket. What did they do? Not just a meltdown, an epic meltdown. I mean, we're talking turnovers, missed front end, multiple missed front end of one-on-ones, bad shot selection, fouling opposing three-point shooters. A disaster. The only reason they were able to survive and advance past NC State in that ballgame is because NC State, well, they made a couple of mistakes of their own, particularly one blown defensive assignment at the very end of the ballgame. And what happens? You know, Kansas wins the game by 3. I lose my bet. My clients lose their bets. And you're sitting there looking at the games on Sunday. You're like, boy, I just got Kansas off a meltdown. Well, now I want them because I think this team's good enough to step up in class and avoid that the next time. What happened yesterday? Obviously, the opposite end of the spectrum. Tight game throughout. Kansas unable to pull away. North Carolina unable to pull away. Well, the Jayhawks closed out that game doing everything right that they'd done the previous game. I see a lot of bettors in the sports books here in Las Vegas get frustrated when teams beat them, when teams don't do what you think they're going to do or what you expect them to do throughout the course of a ball game or in those late game stretches where point spreads are so often decided. And then what happens? The next game, oh, that team stinks. That team killed me. And they'll bet against them and lose both bets. When you have a good team, they didn't play well, particularly during crunch time, well, that might be a team you might want to get to the window supporting the next time around. All right, let's set up the week. We're going to start the MLB previews today. One division per day. We're going to do the AL East here on Monday. And throughout the course of the next 6 days, we'll be doing one division each day. NIT semifinals, we'll break those down tomorrow, both games in the NITs. And, of course, the Big Friday show, make sure you're tuning in because that's when you're going to get our Final Four breakdown. So, busy week, Dave. Now, first, Market Watch. Let's take a look at the opening lines for those Final Four matchups. Kentucky, about 8. Now, you know, this line bounced around yesterday, really did. Opened 9.5 in one chop, 7.5 in the other. Merged in the middle, 8, 8.5, looked like it was going to settle at 9, then back down to 8.5. Now we're sitting in the range of Kentucky, 8 over Louisville. Total there, $138. Ohio State, 2.5 over Kansas. And this line did not have much bouncing around. Opened to 2, 2.5, and has stayed steady at 2.5 ever since. Total there, 136.5. In both games, the early money came on the overs, perhaps a reaction to all four Elite Eight games going over the total, some of which aided by the Drew factor at Baylor, but nonetheless, all four games did cash over tickets. So let's start with a review, Dave. What did you see this weekend that you want to share?
Boy, so many fascinating elements. Let's talk about the Kansas defense, for one, because now 3 games in a row, yeah, the offense has sputtered at crunch time. Taylor still hasn't made a 3-point shot the entire tournament, but when they've had to D up 3 times in a row, close games, down the stretch, you got to stop the other team, and you know what they did? They stopped them. Look at how much difficulty Purdue, NC State, and North Carolina had scoring. Some of the Purdue was actually Matt Painter sort of mismanaging the clock where they didn't try to score hard enough. Those last 2 games, the other teams were trying to score. Kansas just suffocating defense with the inside. Just what an underrated player for the added value that he brings. When you've got 2 shot blockers around the basket, makes it so difficult for any easy points to happen. So I think the Kansas defense, similar to what we could say from Louisville, and credit Louisville for making defensive adjustments. Their zone struggled early against Florida. Rick Pitino, been to these dances a few times before. He makes the proper adjustments. Go back and look at about the last 10 or 12 minutes of Louisville-Florida. Did Florida get an easy look anywhere? So that's one of the things we will look at for teams as we move to the Final Four is, going to be another difficult arena to shoot in. The teams that can reach back and play that particularly tough defense at crunch time, Ohio State has also done it, and it's maybe one of the first factors we'll focus on. Kentucky, haven't had to D up in a key situation for quite some time, not once in the entire tournament so far.
And I think that's at least part of the reason why we've seen as much Louisville money as we have. so far this morning. We saw a little bit last night. You know, it looked like that line was going to settle at 9. And, you know, here it is, down to 8.5 and then down to 8. And that looks to be the prevailing number worldwide right about now. We'll have to see how it plays out throughout the course of the week. But some of that has to do with the fact that we haven't seen Kentucky in a ton of close games. The last time they were in one was the SEC championship game, and, oh, they lost that to Vanderbilt. But we should probably talk about some of the teams that that came up short. You know, the Florida Gators, who just had nothing. I mean, they had that game wrapped up. I had a Louisville ticket in my pocket. My clients did well, and I did not feel good about that game at any point, Dave, at any point. Everyone on the team in foul trouble. Everybody on the team. You know, Florida, even though they were draining threes in the first half, even though they weren't in the second, there was a couple times Louisville cut it at 8. Gators get it back up to 10, 11, 12. Give Pitino credit. Give Donovan uncredit. I thought Roy Williams got out coached badly in the closing stretch. Now, North Carolina's got more talent than Kansas. North Carolina's probably a better team than Kansas, even without their point. The point guard comes in, you know, the freshman comes in, 13 assists, no turnovers over the course of the weekend. I wasn't impressed with Williams' game planning. Obviously, Baylor went down. They failed to cover both spreads. And one thing I love to do in the Final Four, find a team that didn't cover the spread in their previous game and bet on them in the Final Four. Unfortunately, can't do that this year because all four teams that are here today were able to cover the spread in their final game. And Ohio State, you know, again, a team with absolutely no depth. None. Once again, you know, two starters going 40 minutes. Another one going 39, only because he fouled out. Another one going 35, and then Sullinger had 24, only because he was in foul trouble. Otherwise, he would have played close to all 40 minutes in the game against Syracuse. No depth at all for the Buckeyes, and yet Mata coaches them to the Final Four. I give him a lot of credit. Again, you know, we look at the coaching, and it's easy to say after the fact. After the collapse of the number one seeds, Syracuse didn't have their keyest player or one of their key players in Fab Melo. North Carolina goes down without one of their key players, obviously, maybe their keyest player in Kendall Martin. Michigan State, the other number one seed, they lost a pretty important cog in the Big Ten tournament. And I'm just rambling on here, Dave. We can go on and on about this stuff. Here, I'll hand it off back to you.
Now, some elements that are worth breaking down. The Marshall impact for North Carolina was huge because White's numbers were terrific, and give him credit for not turning the ball over. But here's the problem. People could say, well, gee, Roy Williams has 3 lottery picks up front. They should have been able to do better. You could see the problem, though. None of those 3 guys can create their own shot. Zeller inside, Henson inside, even Harrison Barnes on the perimeter. None of those 3 can take the ball off the dribble and create for themselves. So when it got to be crunch time late, because as much as we like White for not turning the ball over, so many of those assists he got were in transition. When it came down to crunch time, okay, 2 minutes left, you need to go create a shot for somebody. Just didn't have that ability. That was the week. We read several people this morning saying, gee, why didn't they get the ball here? Why didn't this guy take the shots? That's not what the North Carolina front court does. They relied so much on Marshall for that. So his absence, you know, is absolutely huge. The Ohio State depth, we'll talk into a pre-rant for when we get to the Final Four. And yeah, we don't want to be old, cranky women complaining about this. But what do you get when you get to the Final Four? One, you get terrible basketball venues. Yeah, they want to get more people in the seats. You're going to sell a lot more tickets. Well, you're selling bad tickets to people who aren't going to be able to see the games very well. So shooting is impacted. But also what's bad, now it helps Ohio State here, the extra long media timeouts, almost to the point where you could run an entire Seinfeld rerun during those timeouts. You're getting up to almost that 3-minute mark, which is pretty bad because it's such a long interruption in play that it can take the teams out of rhythm and out of flow. What it does mean, though, is depth is only an issue if it's foul trouble. Depth is not a pace of game issue at all in the Final Four because you're going to get those 4 3-minute blocks in each half. So the Ohio State depth is not an issue unless Kansas can get them into foul trouble. Kansas doesn't really play that way. You know, their offense isn't designed to get the other team in foul trouble. So, yeah, Ohio State might be able to get away with that short rotation, not because they deserve it, but because the sport changes. The sport that's been played all year now gets changed because the timeouts get longer, something that really shouldn't happen just for a few extra bucks.
And Kentucky, the one team we haven't talked about yet of these Final Four, haven't really broken down. Wow. I mean, that's all you can say. Wow, they played some unbelievable offensive basketball this weekend. And yet, both games, Indiana, and then we saw late in the Baylor, hey, that leads down to 10. Point spread cover in doubt. We're talking about a team that had a ridiculous 1.33 points per possession. For the season, the best team in the country, Missouri, 1.21 points per possession. Kentucky, 1.33 over the course of the weekend. Those are sick, sick offensive numbers. Great defensive team when you look at defensive shooting percentage allowed. And yet, despite all that, despite playing a lineup with five guys that are going to the NBA next year, here they are, sweating out point spread covers. Wonder if Kentucky's going to be able to play as well next weekend as they did this past one, Dave.
It's going to be so much fun with the build-up to that. And we'll talk about this over the course of the week. From an intensity standpoint and a cultural standpoint, Louisville and Kentucky in a Final Four, it's just about as big as it's going to get. Great comment by Rick Pitino that we'll get the exact quote and run it during the week. But he said, given where those two programs are in relation to each other, if Louisville wins, you could have Kentucky fans jumping off bridges. That would be like the ultimate insult to their problem. Of course, one reason why they struggled to cover spreads are pretty darn high. You know, people can see how good Kentucky is. But yeah, that offensive execution. And I'm glad that it got laid out there for people to see it, because we hear all these commentators saying, oh, they're a lousy half-court team. They're selfish. They won't play with patience. They do. See, people who say Kentucky's not well-coached, or say the Kentucky's impatient, haven't watched Kentucky. Those kids pass the ball back and forth to each other. I mean, look at the points they scored this year. Very rarely with anyone ever reaching 20 in any game. That is an unselfish team. Fabulous matchup coming up, though. Kentucky against the Louisville defense, about as good as it gets from a fan standpoint.
I mean, Dave, we talk about the talking heads not actually watching games. I mean, I remember this from the Fab Five at Michigan, where the guy, Bill Walton's on TV. Oh, they're so selfish. And just, I mean, commentator after commentator who clearly hadn't watched a single Michigan game all year is saying, well, this team's no good. You know, this team's this way. You know, there's a lot of bias with these talking heads. And most of them, with the exception of Charles Barkley, don't bet. So the bottom line is you're going to see so many stupid, ill-informed opinions from guys that don't watch college basketball about how good teams are or how bad they are. And there's some blatant racism there. There really is. Bottom line, turn off the volume on the talking heads. Pay attention to us here on Vegas Sports Day. We'll see if we can guide you in the right direction. You've been guiding us in the right direction when it comes to emails and letters. Great questions coming in. Please keep them coming. We'll answer them on air. The address, sportsday@covers.com. Of course, you can follow us on Twitter, @VegasSportsDay, and you can get involved in the community. Make your voice heard. Covers.com/postingforum.
Up next, we change the sound of the show a little bit. Instead of a ball bouncing up and down the court, it's going to be the crack of the bat, AL East time coming up. You're watching Vegas Sports Day.
Are you looking for the latest odds, the fastest scores, the most important trends, and the best matchups and stats? Are you looking for the key late-breaking information that can make you a winner? Well, Covers.com has the answer. The world's largest sports betting community gives you a front-row seat in the heart of the action, from the opening lines to the final scores. If you want to stay ahead of the game, Covers covers the numbers.
No pressure. Hi, I'm Dennis Silvers from, can't think of the name on my damn show, Golf and Other Four-Letter Words, and you're watching the Vegas Video Network, I think.
All right, it's time to get to work on the MLB season. Baseball starts next week, and we're going to start today with the AL East, arguably the toughest division in all of sports. You have three different teams from this division that made it to the World Series in the last 5 years alone, which, of course, is bad news for Blue Jays or Orioles fans, as those two teams have been on the outside looking in for quite some time in this division. So let's start by taking a look at the chart which is going to show us the win totals from last year and the odds to win the division for this year. I'll just read them off real quick. We have the Yankees, who won 97 games, the division title a year ago. They're a $1.40 favorites to win the division again in 2012. Tampa Bay won 91 games last year. They were the AL wildcard team. They're plus 500. You can get 5-1 on the Rays to win the division. You bet it right now. Boston, we remember that epic collapse, 7-20 September. They won 90 games even despite that 7-20 collapse, which tells us how bad the Red Sox were down the stretch. Plus 300 for Boston to win the division. Toronto finished 81-81, 500 team, plus 1,300 to win the division. And Baltimore at 69 wins a year ago. Yeah, they're 100-1 to win the AL East, and you know what? That price is really cheap. Real odds for the Orioles to win the division, 1,000-1, 5,000-1, 10,000-1. You can run a lot of different scenarios where different teams win the AL East, but I think it would take, like, basically every other team's pitcher, every other team in the division's pitcher's arms to fall off for Baltimore to actually have a chance.
Yeah, I mean, when you think about how silly these odds can be sometimes, you can make a case that Baltimore's opening day starter would be no better than the number four starter for any of the other teams in that division. Just a long, long season for that pitching staff. Right off the bat, of course, the Yankees bring the reputation. Individual players that bring reputations. But are they necessarily going to be all that this year? We see a lot of holes, a lot of flaws that can be exploited. Derek Jeter had a great second half. Largely, it's the best baseball we're likely to ever see him play again. A-Rod, we may have already seen the best baseball that he's ever going to play. Curtis Granderson could have a terrific this year and not match what he did last season. Mariano Rivera, showing no signs of age. Well, he's going to at some point.
Never.
Yeah, to maintain that particular level is going to be awfully difficult. Mark Teixeira, a wild card. Lost his confidence. He's lost his stroke a little bit. Can he ever step his game back up? But now maybe the biggest question coming into the season for the Yankees. They were so happy about bringing Pineda in from Seattle. Big kid, dynamic stuff. Throws 94 to 97 miles an hour, does he? Well, actually, no. In spring, it's been 89 to 92. Velocity way off. So now there's a genuine question. Do you start him out in the minors? Let him get that arm strength. Find out what's wrong. Or do you throw him to the Wolves and start him in Yankee Stadium? Because one of the big issues here, young pitcher, successful for the Yankees, name the last one. You know, there's a whole different element of pressure when you go from Seattle to pitching in the Bronx. It's been a long, long time since a young pitcher was able to stand up to that pressure.
Maybe the last guy was Andy Pettitte, who the Yankees just re-signed and who's expected to be on the roster by the beginning of May. Of course, Pettitte now, he's on the wrong side of 40. I believe 39 or 40 years old. So
yeah, it's not the wrong side. We're not doing so bad, are we?
Ish. You know,
maybe it's the right side of 40. Because if he's on the wrong side, so are we.
Well, the bottom line for Pettitte is that he came out and had a real good bullpen session in his first start. Said, "Oh yeah, maybe in 3 weeks I'll be ready." But it's a Yankees rotation where right now, starting out the season, three different guys under the age of 25. And Pineda, you talked about the issues with his velocity. Let's not forget. He was a fly ball pitcher, a perfect fit in Seattle's ballpark at Safeco, not so much in the Bronx. You look at even Nova, who wasn't the guy the Yankees hoped he would be last year. Phil Hughes, unable to live off his promise from 2010. Those three guys all likely to start for the Yanks, but you know the problems the Yankees have, there's at least 25 teams in baseball, they'd love to have those same problems. All right, so some of the stars are a little bit older. All right, so the rotation has some question marks. There's better depth in the rotation now this year, certainly, than there was last year. We haven't even talked about Freddy Garcia, who's likely to open up the season in the bullpen. But the one thing with that Yankees bullpen, I mean, they get to the seventh inning. They're in real good shape. They can shorten the game, which will certainly work in their favor. You know, no, they don't have Jabba Chamberlain. Obviously, that's going to be a big loss. But, you know, who knows if when David Arzma is healthy and good to go for the Bronx Bombers. And, you know, you've got that closed-down trio, and now I've lost my notes here, the closed-down trio in the pen. You have Robertson and Soriano and Rivera. And I know Rivera, every year we say, oh, he can't keep doing it. Well, until he stops doing it, you know, we have to think He can keep doing it. I'm not going to be proactive on Mariano Rivera. He's been too good for too long. The guy's inhuman. And the Yankees, obviously, as the lines show you, they're still the team to beat in this division.
We're not so sure that they are, again, because a lot of these aging players may be a little bit past peak. So we want to find opportunity. Tampa sure brings it at 5-1 at this price point. If you look at what they did last year to get to those 91 wins, 130 different lineups. Joe Maddon just scrambling, patching. So many key players hurt at various times. Scrambling with his bullpen. But you can do that when you've got a couple things working for you. One, phenomenal starting rotation. I mean, you're talking about a team that could throw four guys of ace level, and maybe their number five guy would be a number two for a lot of places. So, yeah, it's possible that four different guys in this Tampa rotation could be a number one for another team. But defense. Not only do these guys get to the ball, but when they get to it, they catch it. One of the tables we like to use is just that team zone rating. Last year, Tampa Bay converted 73.5% of all balls hit on the field into outs. No one else is better than 72.2. That's a big gap between Tampa and the rest of the year. What does that do? Not only does it make your pitchers better, but it makes them more relaxed on the mound. If you know that these guys can go catch the ball in the outfield, you don't mind pitching behind in the count a little bit. Yeah, give into the hitter a little bit. Let him hit to the power alleys if you know guys can make plays. That's very relaxing for a pitching staff, and it's a dynamic pitching staff. So given the way they play the game, and a chance that just maybe that little extra sock in the middle of the lineup. You've got Pena back. You've got Luke Scott. They're not going to hit 30 homers for you, but they both might at least hit in the mid-20s. And if they can do that, that's a big upgrade over last year.
Yeah, I mean, you look at the pitching for Tampa, and you mentioned it. You know, you have James Shields, you have David Price, two guys who have top three finishes in the AL Cy Young Award race in recent years. You have last year's Rookie of the Year in Jeremy Hellickson, and Moore probably, Matt Moore, the rookie phenom, probably the favorite to win the AL Rookie of the Year award this year. So that's four pretty good guys. And the thing with the Rays, and really when we're talking about any of these teams, in baseball, that's a long season. You don't want to make futures bets necessarily based on what the team looks like right now. You want to make futures bets based on, hey, what's this team going to look like in June? Are they going to be buyers or sellers at the trading deadline? What are they going to look like in September? Can they withstand injuries? Tampa's got a great-looking farm system. They've got a lot of young guys that can come up, and they have tradable prospects in multiple situations. So the Rays are one team that absolutely look good now and could legitimately get better throughout the course of the season. We talk about how to bet Tampa on a daily basis. I mean, progression betting, where you start a series betting unders with Tampa, for example. And you bet the first game under, that loses. You bet the second game under for an additional, you know, you up a little bit. Yeah, that game loses, you bet the third game under. So you make at least some profit at any point in the series if one of the games goes under the total. That worked last year for Tampa Bay. They were the strongest under team in the majors, 65-88 to the under, and it worked at home in every single series all year with one exception, and that was when they played Oakland, when the A's were on a 25-2 run to the over after the All-Star break. So that pitching, that defense, that style of betting, boy, it worked very, very well for Rays under bettors last year and has maybe some kind of potential in 2012 as well.
Now, if we think part of the Tampa value comes from the Yankees being overrated, let's connect another dot in here. Let's look at the Red Sox, a team that has issues just about everywhere. Yeah, this lineup is going to hit. They're going to hit better than they did last year. But look at this pitching staff. First, this Boston price almost assumes that Beckett and Buchholz are going to be healthy all season. And, you know, Buchholz has had 1 year in his career of more than 16 starts. There's no guarantee there. But look at the guys fighting out for the number four and the number five slots. Long, long season. If Bobby Valentine's got to send out guys like Bard, Aceves, Cook, Felix Dubront, out of those four, two of the guys are going to have to make the rotation. Bard's been a disappointment in the spring. They might send him back to the bullpen. And even that bullpen raises issues. They want Melanson and Bailey to be the two closers because both show good stuff, show good recent stats. But if you're pitching end games with the Astros and the A's, you're not under a whole lot of pressure. Entirely different story in Fenway, in that hitter's park, in Yankee Stadium when you're on the road. this Boston team, of course, has that magical upside from the lineup, but this pitching staff could implode pretty badly. And let's say if we make John Lester a wash against the top of the Tampa rotation, but Tampa wins at 2, 3, 4, and 5, and even though the bullpen's not necessarily great for Tampa, maybe it's a little more manageable, Tampa should not be at a bigger price, I think, than Boston.
I agree 100%. And the Red Sox, you know, I'm not a Bobby Valentine fan. I'm not. I'm not convinced he was the right hire for the Red Sox. And I'm sure he'll start pissing people off in that locker room shortly if he hasn't done so already. You look at the fact that, you know, Boston can score runs. You know, this lineup is going to be there once again. Jacoby Ellsbury, Dustin Pedroia, Adrian Gonzalez, David Ortiz, Kevin Youkilis healthy after dealing with multiple injuries last year. Couldn't play during that September run. Carl Crawford, he's supposed to have a bounce back year, although here he is recovering from wrist surgery. Not going to go up north with the team just yet. But the offense led the majors in runs scored last year. We have pitching issues. What do we do with the Red Sox? We look to bet them over the total on a game-in, game-out basis.
Next up is a team that's got no chance to win the division, but has a chance to win a lot of money for you, and that's Toronto. One of the things that Toronto's done for our pockets the last couple of years is just golden in non-division play because they don't get evaluated properly because of that strength of schedule. Last year, 53.3% winning percentage outside the division. You can cash a lot of tickets with that. Fun team to watch because you've got some big swatters in that lineup. Some intriguing pitching possibilities. Dustin McGowan, can he get healthy? Kyle Drabek, can he be good enough? So they will be a fun team to watch. Problem is, there's just no way to move up even a notch in that AL East. So what we'll hope will happen when you're playing division games, you want Toronto to lose all of them. Go get swept by the Yankees. Go get beat up in Boston. Then when they step down in class, we can then step in and make a little bit of money.
Yeah, and when you talk about teams that had a very positive spring training experience, I mean, you read the comments coming out of Toronto right now. These guys are psyched. You know, these guys, 19-4 in exhibition play. And again, you don't want to make too much of it, but certainly a positive vibe in that clubhouse right now. You look at maybe the Blue Jays' biggest weakness last year, their bullpen wasn't very good. I mean, a lot of late-game meltdowns. You know, from the likes of Mark Szczepanski and John Rauch and Frank Francisco. That bullpen's been made over. You know, they bring in Jason Frazier back from Chicago. He's a nice addition. Darren Oliver, yeah, he couldn't go back to Texas after what happened in Game 6 of the World Series. Good lefty shutdown specialist. Francisco Cordero is a setup man. Sergio Santos, who was pretty good in the closer's role for the White Sox last year, had some late season meltdowns, but... You know, Casey Jansen, you know, it's a good-looking pen for Toronto, and I'm telling you, if you're looking for one factor in Major League Baseball that's not priced correctly, one of the edges you can find, legitimate edges, is bullpens. You know, you see baseball lines set on starting pitchers and lineups. So when you see teams that have good bullpens or bad bullpens, they're never quite priced properly. And those are the teams you can really take advantage of. And you look at Toronto, you want to take a guy to take advantage of. What about their ace? You know, Ricky Romero last year post All-Star break, dynamite. I mean, really, Blue Jays 11-3 in his 14 post All-Star break, and they lost the first one, so really 11-2 down the stretch. And yet he was only priced higher than minus 140 three times, all against bottom feeders, Baltimore, Seattle, and Kansas City. There's some value with Romero right now. Although McGowan, yeah, he's already hurt. He's got plantar fasciitis. Doesn't look like he's going to make the team. And Drabek's already got sent down to AAA. So some issues in the back end of that rotation for the Blue Jays potentially coming out of the gate.
Some issues at the very top of the Baltimore rotation, in the middle of the rotation, and at the back end of the rotation. It's just so difficult to go into a season with the cluster of starting pitchers that the Orioles have because it does a couple of things to you. Gradually, it drains the confidence of a team. When you're looking up and you're down 4-1 in the third inning, you know, because, you know, getting behind early in games wears on a team over the course of the season. Why does Tampa Bay overachieve all the time? Because they're always in their game. The pitchers keep them there. The defense keeps them there. The Orioles, they lose that focus because, one, the defense isn't very good. You got a couple of big bombers with bats in the lineup. They don't carry the same weight with the gloves out into the field, so the defense isn't good. But the starting pitching, there just isn't an innings eater out there. Could you make an over-under right now that no Baltimore starter tops 175 innings this year? No one's going to get to the 200 level, but now if you've got to keep doing that shuffling all the time, it wears on the other players, it wears on your bullpen, it makes it very difficult for Showalter to have to juggle things. This Baltimore 69 last year, that was almost a max out. Yeah, like when you look at what they did to get to 69, because it's five straight years where they didn't get to 70, that looked like about as much as they could get out of that group, and they haven't tweaked or made changes that lead us to believe it's going to be any better.
Yeah, I mean, you know, Pittsburgh gets the highlights, 20 straight losing years. Baltimore's got 14 now. You know, it's been a long time. I think when they first got Albert Bell, when things started to go south for the Orioles, and they haven't gotten better at any point. And again, you know, you're counting on Jake Arrieta. You're counting on Brian Matisse. You're counting on Zach Britton. These are not aces. You know, none of these guys are proven. They're in a brutal division. And what happens when you have bad starting pitching? Well, the bullpen starts to wear down and continues to wear down and wears down more. No natural leadoff hitter in Baltimore. No natural cleanup hitter in Baltimore. No closer issues right now for the Orioles. And there's nothing worse for a bad team than being unable to win the games they're supposed to win because the closer can't close it out. Baltimore last year, 87-67 to the over. Only the Mets were a stronger over team than the Orioles. And frankly, that to me is my number one way to attack the Orioles coming into 2012. This team might score some runs. They're going to give up runs in bunches. And I'm looking to bet Baltimore in their individual games over the total whenever the situation presents itself appropriately.
Up next, time to shift back to the hardwoods as Money Time begins.
Traditional media believes that after about 3 minutes, you'll tune out. Most Vegas media companies think if it doesn't jiggle, you won't tune in. At the Vegas Video Network, we think both are wrong. The Vegas Video Network is the first and only live online broadcast network that specializes in insider news and expert views about Vegas. We combine great storytelling with the ability to watch when and where you want, on your computer, mobile device, or television. Discover the real Las Vegas. Visit VegasVideoNetwork.com.
Livestream is your premier place to watch live events on the web, mobile devices, and connected TVs. See new events daily or broadcast your own at livestream.com. Livestream. Be there.
I didn't yell at the opening. I gotta yell now. It's money time! This edition of Money Time is brought to you by Covers.com. Remember, for all the key information you need in every sport, Covers covers the number. Let's start tonight in Indianapolis, where the Miami Heat 3-point road favorites over the Indiana Pacers. And, you know, the showdown that wasn't yesterday. Miami and Oklahoma City, an NBA Finals preview, and I think that really is an NBA Finals preview, but the bottom line, Miami... they were no-shows. Really, from an intensity standpoint, Oklahoma City ran them out of the gym. The Heat had been playing phenomenal defense coming into that game. What happened? The Thunder picked them apart. Dunks, layups, open looks throughout the course of the game. Even when the Heat went on a little run in the fourth quarter and Shane Battier hit back-to-back threes, they cut it to eight. What happened? Next couple of possessions, Oklahoma City breaks down that defense again and end up winning by margin in that contest. And the Thunder found something they could exploit in that ballgame. You know, the Serge Ibaka, Kendrick Perkins, combining for 37 points on 16 of 21 shooting. Kevin Durant, 8 assists, matching his season high. And 5 of them directly to Perkins. Not easy to do, 5 assists to Kendrick Perkins in one game. He's no offensive threat unless he's dunking the basketball. That tells us Miami's defense really wasn't there. You can call the 5 assists to Perkins the moral equivalent of filling an inside straight 5 times. Not going to happen that often. Now the question becomes, is it a real problem for Miami? Do they bounce back off of that level of effort? Or did the Heat come out with that same lethargic effort on the defensive end of the floor tonight?
One thing we've been able to see from Miami in that early stages of the Wade and James, they do bounce back pretty well. Naturally, you don't get a lot of opportunities to see them in bounce back settings because they're not going to lose very often, and they're not going to lose bad very often. But let's take a look at what's happened when Miami has lost bad this year. Only four times all season they've lost in double figures. After the first three, they've come back 3-0 straight up and against the spread. Even more importantly, though, they've beaten the spread by 36.5 points. That means they've rebounded from the first three double-figure losses to beat the spread by an average of 12 points that very next game. That shows you where that pride element is. So now we wonder, okay, if we believe the pride element is where it is, and if they're 3-0 straight up and 2-1 against the spread against the Pacers this year, winning by 15 in the only game on this court, might there be a little matchup opportunity? Miami bringing their A game against an Indiana team that doesn't necessarily have an A game yet.
Well, the question here, can Indiana exploit the interior of that Miami defense the same way that Oklahoma City did? Well, it's a much different matchup. The Pacers have not been able to control the low post against the Heat. They don't have an Ibaka-Perkins combination down low, and they've lost the boards by a combined total of 30 in the three head-to-head losses so far this season, two of which were real blowouts. Now, Indiana tied with the Washington Wizards. You never want to be tied with the Wizards in any category, even though Washington on a little bit of a point spread uptick. Bottom line, tied with the Wizards, dead last in the NBA in assists, and that's a big part of the series dominance. Now, this is a Pacers team that's averaged only 86 points per game against the Heat on 38.8% shooting because they simply do not move the ball well enough, certainly not as well as Oklahoma City was able to do in yesterday's contest.
Let's head out to Pullman, Washington. We've got little minor college basketball tournament action tonight. Washington State Pick'em over Pittsburgh. First game of the best of three series in this Invitational. They'll play in Pittsburgh again on Wednesday night. Boy, Washington State has just come out of nowhere in this tournament. A team that seemed flat down the stretch. We didn't think we'd be all that excited to be in these brackets. But take a look at these games. They beat San Francisco, Wyoming, and Oregon State by 51 points, two of those three wins coming on the road. And what should have been a real danger zone for them at Oregon State the last game, you know, Faisal Adam, who had been their leading scorer, was injured back in January. Brock Modum, who's taken over, been the only guy averaging in double figures since Adam went down, he was hurt 2 minutes into the Oregon State game. That should have been it. No, they win going away, stepping up for them. You had Reggie Moore, Abe Lodwick, they combined for 45 points. Now, is this a case of guys who are capable of contributing but didn't have to because the other scorers were there? Is it a case of a chemistry coming together, rallying without the key player out there? They're difficult questions to answer, but the first one we have to get to, what is Modum's status? It's been a while since the Oregon State game. Is his ankle good enough to get him on the court tonight?
Well, it does not look good for Brock Modum tonight. Here's a quote that makes it very clear what he's up against. Quote, "I can't speed the process up in any more way than I'm doing. I think mainly the thing is time. I'm doing everything I can. It's just going to be time until it gets better." And the betting markets are definitely reacting to what we've seen. This information was out yesterday for anyone who wanted to be a little bit ahead of the curve. This pick'em line, looking at the live odds screen right now, not pick'em anymore. The money has come in hard and heavy on Pitt over the course of the half hour since we've come on air. Now we're looking at Pitt minus one, even 1.5 in some of the leading indicator books. And I don't think that number is going to change. And this comes despite the unique format in this tournament. Again, we're talking about the CBI where you play a best of three series. There's nothing else like it in college basketball. So when you look at the history of this tournament, what's happened? The home team for the first game has won straight up every single time. Now, that doesn't mean that they've covered the spread in these matchups, though in this point spread range, obviously, if Wazoo wins the game, they will cover the number. But there's been a decided home court edge in game one of this three-game series, or best of three series, year in, year out. It's not been a tournament that's been around forever, but there's definitely been that kind of an edge to the home team in the first game. Now, you know, some of the success that Washington State has had throughout the course of this tournament, you know, maybe without a key cog, they can get opponents without the ability to scout them properly, but that's not going to happen with Pitt. Pitt has time to prepare and advance scouting for the guys that Washington State was able to rely on to get all that offense, the 45 points in their last ballgame, a couple of career miserable shooters all of a sudden stepping up and playing very well. Well, Pitt's seen them. Pitt's got film on them now. Maybe they have some idea of how to defend them.
Pitt's also been a very interesting ride to this tournament. We just talked about Washington State playing a dynamic game without modem against Oregon State. How about the Pitt overtime win at Butler? So many times you see a score and you just make assumptions until you dig down into it. But look at these two key cogs up front. Nazir Robinson, Ashton Gibbs, they go 1-for-16 from the field. Gibbs didn't score. Missed every shot he took. Those were the two key veterans up front. What Pitt has done in this tournament is some of the younger guys have played well. And that's one of the things you want to look for in these brackets is the guys who are already playing for next season, bringing that little bit of enthusiasm level. Trey Woodall, the floor leader for Pitt, puts us into an interesting perspective. Let's look at how he breaks down how some of these young guys have stepped up for him. We're taking advantage of every opportunity. We're getting guys ready. It's giving a lot of guys the time to get out there and be in heated situations. That will be a good thing for next year. Tells us a couple of things. One, Pitt still has the enthusiasm to keep playing. But number two, if you're Ken Bone in Washington State, who are you preparing for? Because the Pitt rotations are much different than during the regular season. Which means, unfortunately, it's a scramble for us. Yeah, the markets are ping-ponging on this game. Will modem play? Probably not. How much does his absence mean? Who knows? You can almost make a case that win at Oregon State was the best single game Washington State may have played all year. Played well without it. These younger Pitt guys, okay, it's one thing when you're taking a bus to Butler, but now these younger Pitt guys are taking a long plane ride out to Pullman, Washington. Will their poise level be there? Difficult game to break down. So let's go somewhere else for our pockets this evening.
Absolutely. It's play of the daytime. Not going to look at Pitt. And again, the Pitt game against Butler, hey, Butler lost that game. You know, you have two free throws with a second left and you miss them both, so it goes into overtime. That's on the home team, not on the road team. They escaped with the victory. But here's a team we don't think is going to have to escape with the victory tonight. That team would be the Miami Heat minus the 3 at Indiana. Sometimes you lose with the team one day, come right back with the next. Miami's the better of these two squads. We expect a strong bounce-back effort here against a team they match up very well against. Vegas Sports Day play of the day for Monday, Miami minus the 3. And that's going to wrap it up for today's edition of Vegas Sports Day. Thank you for taking time out of your busy day to spend with us. For Malinsky, I'm Savransky. Enjoy the games. Good luck. We'll see you again.